recent decision of Wallace Muhammad, leader of the World Community of Islam in the West, to become an international evangelist for his organization is not surprising. It follows logically from the rightward drift of the group over the years. Muhammad Iman, our spiritual leader, so-called, of the organization once known as the Nation of Islam, are the black Muslims, relinquished his post as head of the group's day-to-day operations earlier this month. He is a staunch supporter of the Carter administration and the U.S. capitalist system as a whole, and leader of what was once the most influential organization in the black community, one that has been through a number of transformations since its beginnings in the 1930s. Nation of Islam originated as an offshoot of the Black Nationalist Garvey movement in its earliest days. The Nation of Islam sought to refute one of the main components of racism, its programs emphasizing blacks were a separate nation and that black history did in fact exist, were important alternatives to the notion that black history was merely one of savagery. Furthermore, the group leaders stressed the necessity of black solidarity with the freedom struggles of third world peoples worldwide. Much like Garveyism, this amounted to an initial radical rejection of the U.S. system and its capacity to end the oppression of black people. There occurred a major decline of the Nation of Islam and other black mobilizations in the 1940s. In this period, the NOI, or Nation of Islam, existed in relatively isolation and concentrated on self-help programs and cooperatives. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the stirrings of civil rights and nationalism began once again. Several years later, a young prisoner was won to NOI, Malcolm X. Malcolm, the black revolutionary leader, was recruited to the group by an older brother while serving a sentence for armed robbery in Michigan. He rose to leadership within the nation soon after his release from prison in 1952. With his activism and brilliant oratory, Malcolm transformed the nation from a sect to a major voice of black discontent. Through rallies, meetings, street corner speeches, and publications of articles and journals, the black Muslims gained massive influence in the black community. The group's most important publications, Muhammad Speaks, was founded by Malcolm X. The group posed as an alternative to the nonviolent leadership of the early civil rights movement, much of which through its support to the two-party system, sellout. The Muslims articulated or voiced black America's sense of solidarity with the rising African and colonial revolutions, and above all, the realizations that nonviolence could not stop racist terror and the possibility of real integration into the capitalist U.S. mainstream was impossible and undesirable. As the Muslim position was typically stated by Malcolm X in the 1950s, if the people in Africa are getting their freedom, then 20 million blacks here in America, instead of shouting hallelujah over what is happening 9,000 miles from North America, should study the methods used by our brothers in Africa and Asia to get their freedom. There are 20 million some blacks in America, yet suffering the worst form of enslavement, mental bondage, mentally blinded by the white man, unable now to see that America is the citadel of white colonialism, the bulwark of white imperialism, the slave master of slave masters, said Malcolm X. Elijah Muhammad, however, while supporting these militant positions, sought to gain black independence, and not primarily by the armed mobilization of the black masses, but by a process of black capitalist accumulation. This position led to de facto abstention from the ongoing civil rights struggles of the late 1950s and early 60s. In addition, the bureaucratic structure of the Nation of Islam provided a basis for the leadership's material privileges. Defense of these privileges became more and more the fundamental concern of those tied to the nation apparatus. These problems led to the 1963-64 split between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. As Malcolm summed it up, "I didn't break with the Nation of Islam. There was a split. I felt the movement was dragging its feet. in many areas. It didn't involve itself in the civil or civic political struggles, or people were confronted by. All it did was stress the importance of moral reformation. When I found that the hierarchy, the leadership at the top itself, wasn't practicing what it preached, it was clear that this was part of the program was a bankrupt. Its national leadership was bankrupt of any moral worth. So the only way it could function and be meaningful to the community was to take part in the political and economic facets of the Negro struggle. And the organization wouldn't do that because the stand it would have had to take would have been too uncompromising and activist, and the hierarchy had gotten conservative. It was motivated by its own self-interest. Group thrust aside. After Malcolm's departure, the nation continued to grow in membership and influence. However, the group was thrust aside by militant blacks, initially by Malcolm's organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU, and later by the rise of militant black organizations such as the Black Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. But with the decline and isolation of these organizations, the black Muslims regained lost strength in the early 1970s in much the same way that the original Back to Islam movement grew with the eclipse of the more militant expressions of Garveyism in the late 20s. Many blacks, disillusioned by the Black Panther Party, joined the nation. This gravitation towards the nation was facilitated by the Panthers' own turn in 1969 to counter institutionalism. When the BP, the Black Panthers, began to create free breakfast for children programs, liberation schools, many black people saw this as what Elijah Muhammad had been doing all along. The nation, from the time of Malcolm's departure until the assumption of leadership by Wallace D. Muhammad, Uncle Tom's sellout in 1975, continued its course of attempting to gain black independence by the slow accumulation of small businesses such as bakeries, supermarkets, fish stores, clothing shops, and so forth. As Elijah had summed it up in point 5 of Economic Blueprint for the Black Man, observe the operations of the white man. He is successful. He makes no excuses for his failures. He works hard in a collective manner. You do the same. And as explained by leading minister Louis K. Farrakhan of New York City in 1970, who was now broken away from the Nation of Islam over the sellout policies of his brother-in-law, in a speech at the Congress of African People, Minister Farrakhan said, "Muhammad says to you, unite with him in this effort to put you on the road to independence." "What do you mean, Muhammad?" Muhammad asked. "How are you going to be independent with your mouth in the white man's kitchen?" "Muhammad is purchasing farmland to feed black people. We have thousands of acres here in Georgia, many thousands now in Alabama, in Mississippi, and several other states." "What are you doing, Muhammad?" "I am trying to prepare a meal for black people so that the black people can feed themselves." This, in sum, was the program of the Nation of Islam, a program of black business development as being the true path for the liberation of black people, which is erroneous. Blacks can never succeed in the system. Most of their farm acreage has now been lost. Black businesses are going downhill. 80% loss of black business in the last 10 years. 80% of them have gone broke in the last 10 years. The finished result in the black nation, according to the Earl O'Farrell in The Myth of Black Capitalism, is that you just can't find liberation through capitalist systems. In the context of capitalist America, the perspective for black economic development was utopian. How could small grocery shops and restaurants hope to compete with the giants of U.S. imperialism? How could Shabazz steak and takes compete with McDonald's and Burger King with their cheaper prices and massive advertising funds? The Nation of Islam business existence was above all a reflection of the political support and solidarity extended to these establishments in the ghetto. Their long-time inevitability, inviability, however, was revealed during the first waves of the 1973-76 economic recession. The economic crisis hit hardest among those upon whom Elijah's economic projects depended, the black workers and unemployed of the ghetto. We'll be continuing this perhaps tomorrow or another day on the Nation of Islam and its rightward turn. We will be linking it to certain white racist elements of a Nazi nature. It has been proven, and it is now substantiated by the press, that Wallace D. Muhammad is a provocateur, and it is he that brought about the rift between Malcolm and Elijah, and he, more than anyone, that brought the Nation of Islam to its right-wing trends, its neo-fascist trends. It is an interesting story, and it will take some time for me to tell you. President Carter formally opens the next round of peace talks between Egypt and Israel tomorrow. At the White House, congressional leaders and members of the diplomatic corps are expected to attend the ceremonies. The negotiating teams will then move across the street to the presidential guest residence to begin a series of long bargaining sessions. Late this afternoon, President Carter meets with the Egyptian delegation, which is expected to arrive in Washington shortly before leaving Paris this morning. Egypt's acting foreign minister told reporters that he hopes the expected peace treaty leads to similar accords between Israel and other Arab countries. Of course, no one in the Arab world is falling for the sellout that took place in Camp David. King Hussein of Jordan has stated his negative position to the Camp David agreement. Addressing the people on his own country, of his own country, of the Arab nation, over radio and television, King Hussein said a settlement should be based on the immediate withdrawal of all the troops from the occupied territories and respect of the right of the Palestinians to self-determination. He demanded the restoration of Arab sovereignty over the eastern part of Jerusalem, the holy city of Muslims. King Hussein had been formerly very right-wing and in the U.S. camp, but he's fastly moving out of it because of Carter's blunders at Camp David. The Lebanese president returned to Damascus today for another round of talks with the Syrian president on the crisis in Beirut. Earlier, he stopped briefly in London after concluding a tour of Gulf states that participate in Lebanon-Syrian-led peacekeeping force. The Lebanon president has called a conference of those states this Sunday on putting an end to the crisis in this country. In Beirut, meanwhile, the ceasefire between Lebanese fascist Christians and Syrian Muslim troops continues to hold firm despite sporadic fighting. The right-wing leader said today of the Christian phalanges that he did not believe the Sunday meeting would bring any conclusive results. He also charged that Syrians used the current truce to bring additional troops and supplies into Lebanon. The Syrians, I guess, has right to enter Lebanon, in that it was a Muslim majority, and Israel marched into it by force of arms and aggression, the Zionist Israeli neo-fascist movement, and they have never yet given up the southern territory of Lebanon that they conquered by force. Rhodesian white prime minister, so-called, or should we say dictator, Ian Smith, says Rhodesia is willing to attend an all-parties conference on resettlement plan for a settlement plan for the country with the black guerrillas or not. Mr. Smith, addressing the National Press Club in Washington, said the patriotic front leaders said they are not interested in such a conference. This is a lie, of course, but Washington is good at carrying out lies on Voice of America. He said nor did they want to talk to Britain alone about the country's status, but he said if there is a chance for a successful constructive conference, Rhodesia would attend. Both Mr. Smith and Executive Council member Satoni maintained that black activist leaders do not support the internal settlement plan because they know they would lose in a free election. This is ridiculous when it's been proven by poll after poll, even in the capitalist world, that 97% of the population, 97% of the population, stand by for a moment, of the entire nation, Yes, 97% of the territory is in the hands of the Patriotic Liberation Front already. They said the guerrillas didn't want a peaceful settlement plan because they knew they would lose in free elections, of course, I said, which is ridiculous. And they would rather gather power, seize power by force, said Prime Minister, who was being given the welcome mat in Washington. Ask about their opinion of the U.S. Ambassador Andrew Young. Ian Smith declined comment, but Mr. Satoni said Mr. Young and British Foreign Secretary David Owen are committed to the Patriotic Front. Well, we're glad that David Owen is standing up for that right principle in Britain, and Young, we hope, we never know where Mr. Young is, back and forth. He said the sooner the USA and Britain find one biased people to deal with, the chances for progress will be better. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Smith and Ambassador Young canceled a meeting which was scheduled for today in New York. By mutual agreement, U.S. spokesman said their meeting was canceled because of the wide disagreement on the Rhodesian crisis, and there was nothing further to discuss. Very interesting. South African Prime Minister Peter Botha meets the Western Contact Group in Pretoria next week to discuss the issue of Namibia's independence. The joke, that is. There's no intention of South Africa to give independence to Namibia. The foreign ministry statement in Pretoria said the prime minister and foreign ministers will meet Monday and Tuesday with representatives from the United States, France, West Germany, Canada, and Britain. The statement said the discussion will concentrate on reaching an internationally acceptable solution for Namibia's independence. The five Western powers have been negotiating with South Africa and SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization, on the independence issue. In Guatemala, the general strike declared Saturday has spread practically all over the country. Another one of USA's dictatorships is about to totter and fall. Unrest began earlier this month when police used tear gas provided by USAID to disperse picket lines and demonstrators protesting against raising city transport fares. The police have used firearms. Where'd they get them from? USA. And tear gas, and 15,000 were wounded in the process. The demonstrators, however, continue to demand this restoration of democracy. That's the kind of courage that human beings of any worth are made of. And that's what a socialist should be. Fearless. Fearless of death or anything in life. Hungary's deputy foreign minister has called for more energetic actions against racial oppression in South Africa. Speaking at a session of the United Nations Anti-Apartheid Council, he indicated that oppression against black people in South Africa has been intensified. In a letter to the UN Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, the People's Voice of the German Democratic Republic, a modern communist East German state, restated solidarity with the oppressed people of South Africa. The Security Council has approved a resolution of criticizing the United States for permitting the head of the racist regime in Rhodesia, Ian Smith, to visit their country. The granting of the visas to Smith is a violation of the United Nations sanctions, which bans any material or moral support to the authorities in the illegal government of Salisbury, Rhodesia, which should be called Zimbabwe. The resolution demanded that the United States observe all of the sanctions strictly, as they are so strict to demand of others. No talk of human rights these days by Carter. There's not much he can say. The Nicaraguan dictator Somoza is bombing all of his people to death, and so is the Guatemalan dictator. Not a word from Carter. The United States, Great Britain, West Germany, and Canada all abstained at the meeting. What else would you expect? They're not going to vote. Sanctions are all capitalist or capitalist controlled, as Canada's 70% controlled by USA. The United States' plans for the manufacture and deployment of the neutron weapon has come under sharp criticism at the United Nations General Assembly. The German Democratic Foreign Minister, Austin Fischer, said the neutron bomb is a vicious hazard to human rights. The neutron bomb kills people and saves property for the capitalists, as you know. His country, the German Democratic Republic, communist ally of the Soviet Union, has an unconditional ban on this type of offensive weapons. Its use by NATO countries, he warned, would lead to another round in the arms race and the ultimate of nuclear hell. The foreign minister of Mongolia has asked the United States to accept the Soviet proposal for renunciation of neutron bomb production. The Federation of Latin American Journalists has charged that the United States is responsible for the occurrence of the dictatorial regime in Nicaragua. That's quite a statement. All the Latin American Journalists Association. They say Washington is giving assistance to this madman Somoza. The statement draws occasion to the mass murders going on in Nicaragua committed by the National Guard on orders from the dictator. Some 100,000 people have now died are missing at the hands of the guards and paid mercenaries, and the money is supplied by our tax dollars, and it's a matter of record in every newspaper across the world. It should cause us to hold our head down in shame. A Libyan economic delegation started talks in Moscow on Wednesday on the prospect of cooperation with the Soviet Union. The Libyan economy is a great socialist economy, as you know. You should read much of that and review that economy. I have a whole text series on that, and it should be put up for you to review, because sometime we're going to refer to testing about it. Soviet participation in Libyan gas and oil project has been discussed. Again, I would have a lot of letters prepared, if we could, Jan, for this Libyan mission here. They are fantastic in their applications of socialism. We should praise them for their achievements. In the Soviet Union, the Red Cross, the Central Trade Union Council, the Peace Council, and other associations have decided to help Vietnam. Medical supplies, food and goods will be sent to this country. The Red Cross is also giving aid to the flood victims of Laos and the many victims in West Sahara who are dying of starvation and dying of thirst due to cloud seeding by the CIA. Soviet experts have worked out methods of prolonging the periods of man's active life. One of the world-leading dermatologists from the Soviet Union says medicine can control the process of aging. Perfected preparations and vaccines are being developed. Among the methods are tissue transplantations and physical exercises. Longevity centers are open with free clinics in the Soviet Union where patients can get consultations and treatments. In the famous doctor's opinion, man's active life can be extended 30 years at present. The average lifespan of the country of the USA and Soviet Union is 70. USA is a little bit longer than their lifespan has increased a little longer than USA. That's quite something, because still over 50 years ago, when they were living in feudalism, their average life expectancy was something like 29. That shows the power of socialism. Italian Red Brigade shot and killed a noted criminal investigator in Naples today. They're going after those investigators and judges who condemn the revolutionaries there. This is a second such assassination in the last 24 hours. The left-wing urban activist group, Prima Liria, claimed responsibility for today's shooting of the head of the Naples University Institute of Criminal Anthropology. His death followed the Red Brigade's claim that yesterday they had assassinated a prominent Italian judge who has been involved in recent investigations and judgments against those of the group and their activities for liberation. Italian Communist Party leader Enrico Berlinguer returned home today after 2 days of talks in Yugoslavia with President Tito. A joint communique issued at President Tito's resort home noted the need for open discussion between parties and movements with the full respite for the independence of each. Mr. Berlinguer's the head of the Communist Party of Italy, in his Yugoslav visit, followed similar talks in Paris with French Communist Party leaders and in Moscow with Soviet officials. The U.S. dollar again plunged downward horribly on the world money markets today as the price of gold soared to another new all-time high. It's up in the $2.40 an ounce. At Frankfurt, the dollar fell $240. $240 an ounce. At Frankfurt, the dollar fell to its lowest point yet against the West German mark and lost strength against every other currency, in spite of intervention by several banks. Earlier today in Tokyo, the West German Chancellor, the capitalist West Germany that prides itself as being the third inheritor of the Third Reich, of Hitler's call for joint German-Japanese efforts to help stabilize the world economy before there's a total economic collapse in capitalism. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi met in London today for wide-ranging talks with British Prime Minister Callaghan, but few details of the discussion have been reported at this time. We looking at other points of the news, we shall see if there's anything else that has any particular striking effect. I think there'll be just one thing that we'll give in the last closing session of this news. It'll be something about health. I would like to mention that a black woman who is pregnant has been arrested in Chicago for protesting, and she will be sentenced to a period in which she'll have to give birth to the baby inside the prison institution, beginning now to be quite inhumane. She was just simply demonstrating against her right to job benefits and striking in a peaceful protest way. But she was sentenced to 1 year, which means that her baby and she will have to be born, will have to be born inside the prison. Tips for avoiding kidney stones. You can reduce your chances of being among the one out of every six Americans who suffer from kidney stones during their lifetime, says a prominent physician. So that means we have a better chance here. We have much less of it. Kidney stones are very rarely kill anyone, said Dr. Vernon Smith, but those who get them wish they were dead. It's very severe pain. Dr. Smith, professor of urology at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, offered the following tips for avoiding kidney stones. Increase fluid consumption until urine output is more than 2 quarts per day. Any fluid, that means you've got to take at least, how many glasses is there in a quart? 8 glasses, is it? That's 16 glasses, 2 quarts. Anyway, whatever. 2 quarts a day. You've got to drink that much water. Any fluid is fine except tea, which has been found to be an aggravating factor. Eat fewer fleshy foods, such as meat. Here again, we find another medical release that meat is not good for our health. If you do eat meat, stick to the poultry variety and fish. Substitute grains and cereals for fleshy foods wherever possible. I can say without a doubt that drinking plenty of fluids has and a modified diet can cut kidney stone formation in 60% of the patients, Dr. Smith said. But it's difficult to get people to stick to a diet of any kind. As for increasing fluid intake, he said the only way to know if you're drinking enough fluid is to collect all the urine you produce in 24 hours. If it's more than 2 quarts, you are drinking enough fluids. There are several theories about this, but the most acceptable is that stones are formed because the things that are in solution in the urine make a stone. They make crystals, and the crystals get together and make a stone. So if you keep them diluted, the chances of them developing into kidney stones are obviously far less. Dr. William C. Thomas, Jr., who is professor of medicine at the University of Florida's College of Medicine in Gainesville, agreed. He also explained why fleshy meats contribute to kidney stones. If you eat a lot of meat of any kind, you put out more uric acid in your urine, he said. And uric acid crystals promote the formation of oxalate, O-X-A-L-A-T-E, crystals, which we think is the aggravating factors that cause one out of six Americans to have kidney stones. And as he said, when you have them, you wish you were dead. They won't kill you, but rarely. But you do wish you were dead from just the enormous pain. Remember tonight, a language class. Thereafter, there may be a film Sounder after some commentary on the news. It's a very good thing the way you're doing it. You may start the commentary on the news first and show it graphically. This will help people. And then brief language class, and then Sounder, excellent movie Hollywood movie on a black family. Thus is the ending of the commentary. I say much love, and you will show your love and your labor so we can liberate our people from the oppression that is so terrible there. Some who run from this place and are caught and come back diseased, as the last two have. The young man's burning with temperature now. They want to get away from this place, while others are begging, literally crying out to find this place. Of interesting last-minute news, Mayor Moscone in, I don't know where I have that, someplace close by, Mayor Moscone. Finally, I guess he's got an awareness he ought to have stood up for People's Temple when the time was right. He sort of forgot People's Temple, you know, like we weren't around. That's rather dangerous. You should always remember that when one person's liberty is threatened, another is also threatened. But he didn't, and he kept as far away from us as he could during that period, if you remember. And he is in a lot of difficulty. I'm not happy about the fact that he's in difficulty, but Mayor Moscone has been